turn to the first chapter of Proverbs. That's page 428 in the Pew Bible. The lesson tonight is really an extension from the last point that we were making in the lesson this morning. And in that point, we were talking about, relative to marriage, that it is not enough for us simply to idealize certain characteristics or principles that we consider to be lofty and give lip service to those principles and not implement them either as individuals to actually take upon ourselves the character traits that would help our marriages, or to not implement them as a couple, to not work together in trying to raise our marriages and the relationships that are at the heart of the marriages, to raise that relationship and marriage to a higher level, and to try to make it all that it can be, all that certainly God would have us to enjoy in this life, in sharing the very depths of our soul with another human being. I've said before in other lessons that this is not to say, any of these concepts that we're talking about, that those that are not Christians cannot have a good marriage. I think God instituted marriage for mankind, knowing that not all of mankind would choose to recognize Him and serve Him. And so as a social institution and the foundation of society and the nurturer of the young, marriage is something that is for everyone. And marriages can last and marriages can be fulfilling, even among those perhaps who don't believe in God. But I don't think that's going to happen among those people unless they are, if you will, accidentally putting into practice some things that God says is really at the heart of relationships. And maybe accidentally is not the right term, inadvertently. One way or another, we're going to have to observe some of these basic principles of human relationships if our marriages are going to work. Now, those of us who are Christians, we're held to a higher standard. We claim to know God, and we claim to acknowledge the wisdom of the Word of God. And we at least verbally claim that we're trying to reach these higher levels, these higher plateaus of relationship, and actually the two becoming one flesh, even in our spiritual sharing. And I think certainly husband and wife reach the pinnacle of relationship when they are in joined together, trying to help each other get to heaven. And what that means is praying together and worshiping together, and serving the Lord together in all kinds of situations. And I think that really becomes the highest standard of marriage, the highest level of relationship. Not to demean others, certainly. But what I want to do in the lesson tonight is I just basically want to do some reading and a little bit of commentary, but I want us to think about some of the proverbs relative to marriage. And I think the Proverbs generally are talking about what is good and positive from a pragmatic point of view. These are things that work. And they work in human relationships because they come from God. These are revelations of God. These are inspired maxims about how people can get along in this world. And some of the things that we'll talk about tonight, some of the things we'll read aren't specifically being applied to marriage, but let's apply it to marriage and see if the truth that is being taught generally about relationships doesn't fit in to the marital relationship. So many things God says to us about our character and what He expects out of us does carry right over into the relationship that we may have with our husband or wife. I'll start, we will together, by reading some from chapters 1, 2, and 3 of Proverbs. And then we're going to look at some specific proverbs having to do with relationship. As we read what is going to be wisdom personified here, it's going to be, as it were, wisdom as a person calling out to us to pay attention to it, to him. Think about what's being said relative to that wisdom and the rejection of the wisdom. What about the availability that is ours of wise living and yet our rejection of it? Proverbs chapter 1, verses 1 through 7. The Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel, to know wisdom and instruction, to perceive the words of understanding, to receive the instruction of wisdom, justice, judgment, and equity, to give prudence to the simple, and to the young man knowledge and discretion. A wise man will hear and increase learning, and a man of understanding will attain wise counsel. To understand a proverb and an enigma, the words of the wise and their riddles, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. I'd like to point out there verse 4, to give prudence to the simple, to the young man knowledge and discretion. I've said before in some previous lessons on marriage, God expects us to be successful in marriage without previous practice. That means if we're entering into marriage at 19, 20, 21, 22, 23 years of age, early on in life, it's not to say that we'll have certainly the experience and the understanding of things that we'll have 30 years later. But our first husband and wife are not practiced. They're not throwaways. So without experience, how do you bring into the marriage as a young person qualities that are going to foster that relationship? And I think simply the answer in a word is wisdom. Well, how can you have wisdom being so young? Because the wisdom actually comes from God. It comes from a trust in Him, which we talked about this morning. It comes from respecting His Word and understanding that He's the Creator and He has told us what kind of character traits are going to help us blend in this world. And so the one who has the best chance of bringing something to the marriage early on in life is the one who's paid attention to God and tried to mold and shape their life according to His revelation. Verses 20 through 27 of chapter 1. Wisdom calls aloud outside. She raises her voice in the open squares. She cries out in the chief concourses, at the openings of the gates in the city. She speaks her words. How long, you simple ones, will you love simplicity? For scorners delight in their scorning, and fools hate knowledge. Turn at my reproof. Surely I will pour out my spirit on you. I will make my words known to you. Because I have called and you refused, I have stretched out my hand and no one regarded. Because you disdained all my counsel and would have none of my reproof, I also will laugh at your calamity. I will mock when your terror comes. When your terror comes like a storm and your destruction comes like a whirlwind, when distress and anguish come upon you. That's pretty strong words from wisdom. But what's being said here is, wisdom is available. Wisdom calls aloud outside. She raises her voice in the open squares. Where are you going to get your wisdom? Where are you going to get your principles or your maxims? Where are you going to get the foundation for your marriage? What's going to be the basis of how you treat your husband or wife and what values you incorporate into your decision-making? Supermarket tabloids, self-help books, over-the-counter counseling. You know, when you begin to look around at the conventional wisdom of the day, it's extremely complicated, contradictory. What seems to be in vogue today is gone next year because more books have to sell next year. And so whether it's, you know, something as physical as a diet or spiritual as a marital relationship, the thoughts of man morph, they change, they evolve. So where are we going to get our wisdom? Where are we going to find the true basis on which to say to my husband, my wife, this is how I will treat you. This is how I'm going to act in regard to you. These are the standards by which I'm entering into this relationship. And wisdom says, I'm here, wisdom from God. I'm here, I'm available. I'm not hidden, I'm crying aloud in the streets. The problem usually is not that we don't know. The problem usually is we don't implement what we know. Proverbs chapter 2, verses 1 through 15. My son, if you receive my words and my treasure my commands within you, so that you incline your ear to wisdom and apply your heart to understanding. Yes, if you cry out for discernment and lift up your voice for understanding, if you seek her as silver and search for her as hidden treasures, then you will understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God. For the Lord gives wisdom. From His mouth come knowledge and understanding. He stores up sound wisdom for the upright. He is a shield to those who walk uprightly. He guards the paths of justice and preserves the way of His saints. Then you will understand righteousness and justice, equity in every good path. When wisdom enters your heart and knowledge is pleasant to your soul, discretion will preserve you. Understanding will keep you, to deliver you from the way of evil, from the man who speaks perverse things, from those who leave the paths of uprightness to walk in the ways of darkness, who rejoice in doing evil and delight in the perversity of the wicked, whose ways are crooked and who are devious in their paths. One thing that's said by wisdom here is that to obtain it, it must be desired. It's not that it's scarce, and it's not that it's camouflaged. It's there for the taking. But there must be a desire for it. Verse 3, if you cry out for discernment and lift up your voice for understanding. So it's like wisdom is crying out in chapter 1 to be heard, and here's the seeker crying out for it. Both are searching for each other. The wisdom that's from God is searching for the man who wants it. And the two will find each other. But are we looking? How hard are we looking? Chapter 3, verses 1 through 8. My son, do not forget my law, but let your heart keep my commands. For length of days and long life and peace they will add to you. Need I say in our families? Length of days and long life and peace they will add to you. I mean, even scientific studies have been done showing the longevity of those who are married. And that it excels those usually who are single, or it does on average. There's something too practical to be brought to our lives that even will stretch the length of life, not to mention the happiness of it. Let not mercy and truth forsake you. Bind them around your neck. Write them on the tablet of your heart. And so find favor and high esteem in the sight of God and man. In our families, can I throw that in without corrupting the text? Doesn't it apply in our family? Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. That verse encapsulates what I'm trying to say. Build our relationships and marriages on God's wisdom and revelation, not on our own or the conventional wisdom of the day. Verse 6, in all your ways acknowledge Him and He will direct your paths. Do not be wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord and depart from evil. It will be health to your flesh and strength to your bones. It takes wisdom to live life well, to make good choices in life that are not only going to provide some material framework in which to live, but choices that the end results of which are going to be the right results. You know, it's so very difficult to decide something today that will have a good outcome next year, or 5 years, or 10 years down the road. We so often decide something at the moment that sounds so right and it feels so right. We implement that only to see deterioration over the long haul. Our desires may not coincide with the best decision. So where will we look again for the impetus of doing the right thing? Will we look within ourselves? In our marriages, will we just follow our feelings? Will we just let our impulses dictate how I speak to my wife, how I speak to my husband? If I'm tired and cranky, that's how I'll respond. If I'm happy, I might say something good and pleasant. If I'm angry and upset, is that going to dictate what comes out of my mouth? If I feel that I've been hurt, shortchanged, insulted in some way, I mean, what's the level of my decision-making toward my mate? Is it how I feel? Is it my desire? Is it my impulse? Or will I base my behavior and my attitudes on something higher? Well, I want to share with you in the bulk of the lesson, what's left of it tonight. I just want to share some of the various Proverbs, and we certainly can't do this exhaustively, so I'll just throw some out and encourage you to do this on your own. Read through the Proverbs and say, if wisdom dictates this is how I behave, what difference might that make in my marriage? You can do this for yourself. Proverbs can be, among other sources in the Bible, can be a marital guide and a help to us in treating our mates properly. Look at chapter 16 and verse 24. New Testament certainly has some things to say about the tongue, our speech, what we say to others. I don't know. I don't know how to gauge this. I don't want to go too far and exaggerate the point. But even in marriages that outwardly are intact, they're not perhaps in danger of breaking up. But I wonder at home behind closed doors, especially when the heat gets turned up and there's controversy, how we might speak to one another. What really comes out of our mouths when we feel wrongly like the rules are different at home? So the Proverbs have several things to say about our speech and our words. Verse 24 of chapter 16, pleasant words are like a honeycomb, sweetness to the soul and health to the bones. Does that apply everywhere else besides marriage? Or don't you think that would have a lot to do with the spirit, the atmosphere of a husband and wife, whether they speak pleasantly to one another? This is a great challenge for those that we live with continually. I'm going to tell this. Martin, you can stop me if you don't want me to say it. But Martin told me a story this morning about counseling young marrieds early on and getting them to make a commitment that they would not, even in jest, say something negative about their mate for the first year. I think that's a great maxim, proverb, if you will, to walk by. And to get a young couple in the habit of speaking well of each other. And you know, sometimes we do that. We have these veiled barbs, you know, that when we get around in a group, or maybe the guys are off to themselves and they get to comparing notes. And, you know, well, my wife, you know, I'll tell you, that's nothing, my wife, and we're, you know, ha-ha. Or especially in a mixed setting, you know, oh, just kidding, dear. Well, sometimes there are veiled messages in those ha-has, in those little supposedly harmless comments that can sting, can bite deeply. Pleasant words are like a honeycomb. And we need to practice that. It's, you know, we can read 16:24 and think, that's a great ideal. It's a great standard to work for. It doesn't seem to happen in my marriage. You know, make it happen. Decide this is how I'm going to speak to my husband or my wife. Chapter 17, in verse 27. He who has knowledge spares his words, and a man of understanding is of a calm spirit. A calm spirit and sparing words. Does that describe how disagreements go in your marriage? Calm spirits prevail and words are spared? Or is it like, the more you get like this, the more words just start flooding out? I don't practice that very well personally, but I have had that cut out and taped in front of my computer to try to help me realize how I should react to situations and to people. He who has knowledge spares his words, and a man of understanding is of a calm spirit. Does that apply everywhere else besides marriage? Do you think it would apply well to how we might deal with each other, especially in times of controversy in our marriages? Chapter 18 and verse 21, death and life are in the power of the tongue, and those who love it will eat its fruit. So much attention needs to be placed on our words and how we express ourselves, and whether we're building up with them or tearing down with them. And I suspect that a lot of the atmosphere in marriages that might not be the best could change if we would implement that one principle in those three Proverbs. That one principle. Remember, it's not enough just to admire some ideal. Somewhere, sometime, we've got to say, that's going to be me. I'm going to really work on that. Whether it's cutting it out and putting it on your computer, or taping it to the refrigerator, or writing it on your whiteboard, or whatever. Get it in front of my thinking. Some of our friends have a habit of putting sticky notes up all over the place, and they have Bible verses on them, and proverbs, maxims, little sayings or poems that they've heard here and there. That's not a bad idea to keep us in mind day by day of what we should be aspiring to. Back in Proverbs 14, verses 16 and 17, in talking about the controversies leading perhaps to anger and rash words being spoken, let's read some things about anger. Proverbs 14, 16 and 17, a wise man fears and departs from evil, but a fool rages and is self-confident. He who is quick-tempered acts foolishly, and a man of wicked intentions is hated. There again, if we would just realize the damage done by out-of-control emotions and the words that so often follow, how much better of an atmosphere we might create. 15:1, not just perhaps we being the angry one, but how do you respond when anger is directed at you? A soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. Verse 18, a wrathful man stirs up strife, but he who is slow to anger allays contention. How often is it that when something is being directed at me that's maybe unfair, uncalled for, groundless, baseless, but now I've got an angry face right here. Yeah. Or if not that, there's just something said with a little raise to the voice. And so now we, the respondent, we have a choice to make. How am I going to answer this? How am I going to respond to this? Because there's that little, you know, you felt the jab. This could spiral out of control based on what I'm going to say next and maybe how I'm going to say it. How good are you at calming the waters that are getting rougher and easing the emotions that are beginning to run high? I think we all admire 15:1. A soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. A soft answer, wouldn't we all like to have that kind of self-control? That in the midst of the thing getting away from us, we're able to keep our calm, able to keep it reined in, and find the right thing to say that would defuse the situation or get it back on the right track. That is an admirable quality. It's one that's worthy of our attention and our work. In chapter 17, in verse 14, the beginning of strife is like releasing water. Therefore, stop contention before a quarrel starts. Boy, what a great quality that is, to be able to stop contention. Because once it gets loose, you know, it's hard to get back in the bottle. Well, look at chapter 15, verses 16 and 17. What about the relative importance of love and peace in our relationship over and against the material things of life? How much effort, perhaps, are we putting into our marriages to have a stable, peaceful, enriching relationship as opposed to the effort that's going into providing the right home and accoutrements that we may desire? Chapter 15, verses 16 and 17. Better is a little with the fear of the Lord than great treasure with trouble. Better is a dinner of herbs where love is than a fatted calf with hatred. I love the way this is said, you know, the old terminology, the old way of life, the fatted calf, if you will. Better is a dinner with herbs. Better to sit down with two chairs between you and a little bit of salad on the table, but you love each other and you're peaceful, and you got somebody that you can trust and depend on, will lift you up and is devoted and committed to you, then a T-bone steak when you're at opposite ends of a 15-foot table and refusing to speak. You know, you may live in the mansion that you've always dreamed of, but you can't stand the person that you're living in it with. Proverbs says, give me a little with love, then a whole lot where there's strife and contention. Chapter 17 and verse 1, better is a dry morsel with quietness than a house full of feasting with strife. I think you get the point there. Go back to Proverbs chapter 6. We had this particular verse in our study in the auditorium class this morning about our attitudes toward our work. Several proverbs have to do with laziness, more politically correct, lack of industry perhaps. But at the bottom line, it's just laziness and a lack of desire to get up and live the kind of productive life the Lord would have us to live. Chapter 6, beginning in verse 6. Go to the ant, you sluggard. Consider her ways and be wise, which, having no captain, overseer, or ruler, provides her supplies in the summer and gathers her food in the harvest. How long will you slumber, O sluggard, when you rise from your sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep, so shall your poverty come on you like a robber and your need like an armed man. There are so many other good proverbs along that same line. There's a lion in the streets. Don't go out. You know, don't plant anything, it might rain. You know, the mindset is to do as little as possible to get by instead of being industrious. And it's not just a life maxim, but I think it also applies, again, in our marriage. A spouse that will not either work in terms of industry, whether it's the wife working within the home or the husband working outside of the home, but even beyond that, just working at the relationship and putting energy into everything that goes into maintaining a home and a family together. The spouse that will not pull their weight, that it instead has to be pulled by the other one, is such a difficult drain on a marriage. Industry is very important. And I'll tell you, they're just, you know, with genetics, some people come out industrious and other people come out liking to relax. And so it may be that this is something you have to fight. In fact, many of these things we're talking about here, it might be your natural inclination is the other way. But you know, we talked this morning about becoming one flesh, the two becoming one, and the responsibilities that we take on. And it's no longer the fact that I just like respite and relaxation, but I have responsibilities and duties to my mate. And I may not feel like giving up and doing this or that, or I may not like having to maintain the house or the relationship or the income or whatever it is. But it takes a lot of work to maintain a marriage. It takes a lot of work to maintain a household before you even add children into the mix. And laziness does not enhance the marriage or the family as a whole. Well, I don't know how much of that may be directed at men. I know that there's potentially that problem on both sides of things. But, you know, there's something that may be particularly male in some of these Proverbs. There's a lot said about adultery in the Proverbs, and that's mostly directed at men. But we have some things directed at wives. Chapter 19 and verse 13. A foolish son is the ruin of his father, and the contentions of a wife are a continual dripping. Chapter 21, verses 9 and 10. It is better to dwell in a corner of a housetop than in a house shared with a contentious woman. The soul of the wicked desires evil. His neighbor finds no fault in his eyes. I don't know why I read that. Doesn't seem to fit. You know, we talked again in our class this morning, if you were in there, about a man who, or a woman for that matter, becomes a workaholic. And what might be behind someone who desires to spend more time in the office or the workplace or away from the family, as it were, than at home. And this can be one of those things that drives a man to stay away from his family. And that is the contentions of his wife. That there is no pleasant speech. There is no attempt to build up and to strengthen him and to make him feel important to the family. So much rides on how we speak to each other and what we project in that speaking. That you are loved and you're valued and I want you here. The message may be, inadvertently or not, I'm just as happy when you're not here. Or the husband may simply conclude that because of the unpleasantness of the situation. And to the wives, you know, what are you projecting to your husband? Would he perhaps see you in the category of a contentious wife? One that perhaps tends to tear down in her family. And there's a proverb to that effect. I don't have it in the notes. But the foolish woman who tears down her house with her hands. Or are you in the category of one who is speaking sweetness and softness to try to build up and strengthen your husband so that he wants to be there with you? I think what troubles me about some of the things that we're seeing in these Proverbs is so many of these things, though we can fool each other, so many of these things can be seen before we ever say, I do. And sometimes we go ahead and say, I do. And as I said this morning, we have to give serious consideration to who it is we're marrying and what qualities they have. We talked about this even some last Sunday. When we say, I do, we did. And we're bound. And we have the responsibility now of making the most and the best of that situation that may not be ideal. But before we say, I do, we have the power to walk away and not make the covenant. And I would plead with any who are here that are single to think carefully and as objectively and rationally as you possibly can in the midst of hormonal excesses and emotional excesses that are going on that tends to absolutely destroy reason. Think as carefully as you possibly can, not about the wedding, but about the marriage that follows. And ask yourself, is this a quality, a trait that I can live with? Because you can't count on the fact that you can change it. Well, I'll make sure I change that over time, Buster. And you become the contentious wife, the continual dripping. There are things that you're going to have to decide beforehand. I can live with that if it never changes. And that's not an easy thing to do because we tend to lack objectivity at that point. Chapter 19 and verse 11. The discretion of a man makes him slow to anger. It is to his glory to overlook a transgression. There's probably some other things we could cite in Proverbs about forgiveness, overlooking transgressions, but that is so fundamental to a marriage, so vitally important that we're able to absorb wrongs and abide the imperfections of our mate. When things are said, perhaps in anger, they get out of control, to be able to forgive and to not wear it out on our sleeve and throw it up in our mate's face when we need to score a point, but to forgive it. We won't forget, but we don't have to bring it up. To forgive and truly mean it and go on because I value the relationship more than I value my ego. More than I value the feelings of vindication the next time we get into something. I can pull that out and remind her what she said last time. I've got to love the marriage more than being vindicated. I've got to love the peace and the harmony and the endurance of the relationship. And to be what God wants me to be. I mean, that's the ultimate point. I've got to love wanting to be what God wants me to be. And that's going to drive me on past the injury and forgive and carry on. Well, you can do this on your own again. There's just some suggestions. But think about these things and other things in the New Testament about our character as God's people. And bring them into the marital relationship and think about them and say, how much better would my marriage be if I would implement these things? You can't, you know, go take Proverbs and whack your mate over the head. But you can take the Proverbs and say, you know, I can implement these changes. I can become this kind of a person with these characteristics. I think we would be amazed at what we would see coming back at us if we would take it upon ourselves to make these changes. We noticed at the beginning of the lesson some things said by wisdom about rejecting counsel. The Scriptures are full of examples of those who rejected wise counsel and they paid the price for it. The short list: Adam and Eve, Noah's warnings to the entire world, Pharaoh ignoring the words of God through Moses, Joshua and Caleb's encouragement to go in and take the land, ignored and rejected, Ahab rejecting the advice to not go into battle, Judas, much as the Lord tried to save him and get him to change his course, yet he rejected that. Sometimes we say in one of our little proverbs of the day, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. And what that proverb really expresses is the frustration of parents, teachers, elders, preachers, counselors trying to help brethren who are having trouble. And you can see the way that perhaps they need to go. And you can see some repairs and some fixes. But at the end of the day, the only thing you can do is suggest and exhort and encourage and pray. But it's up to each and every one of us to take these principles and apply them ourselves to our character and to our relationship in marriage. That rests with each and every one of us as free moral agents to either accept or reject the counsel of the Word of God and the wisdom that's available to us from Him. And the bottom line of this is we accept and we transform. We talked about this morning. We transform and we become happy. And I mean that in the deepest sense. Truly, deeply joyous. Or we reject these things. And the Proverbs calls the one who does foolish. We reject these things. And we continue to have the kind of difficulties and problems perhaps in our families as has been present in the past. Bottom line, I suppose, of all of this is what, again, we've been talking about in our Sunday morning class in the auditorium is attitude. What is going to be our attitude toward our mate, toward our marriage, toward God who encourages us to have a certain character and bring that into the marriage and help it to build that relationship on a solid foundation? What about you? Is there something you need to go home and have a conversation with your husband or wife about? Is there a matter between you that can be helped by the elders or some other wise person here? Is there something that needs to be changed? Is it something private within yourself that you need to go home and just meditate between yourself and the Lord and say, you know, Proverbs touches on something that points out my mistake, my weakness, my flaw. I need to work on that. I hope that we've given some food for thought that will help us grow and have better marriages and better relationships. We're going to sing a song to encourage you and to cause reflection and make you think about where you are spiritually, even as you're here tonight. And should you decide that in singing this song, or perhaps with some thoughts that you had when you came tonight, that there are things amiss in your life spiritually that need to be corrected now, and we can help you do that by prayer, by an acknowledgement of some public nature, by baptizing you into Christ and to begin your walk with Him and be transformed in the best sense of the term. Can we help you while we stand and sing?